But I remember exactly at that moment, two Apaches flew over, and Apaches weren't allowed to fly in Helmand because it was actually a different area. It was meant to be the Marines, but they were our US Army guys, and they had just literally broken boundaries and decided to fly overhead and join in. And that moment, we have our Anzac Day, dude. It's on the 25th of April. It's when we sort of celebrate that Anzac spirit and create that landing at Gallipoli. And Anzac spirit for us is about those who fight through in the face of, you know, hell on earth, and that, you know, spirit to fight through. And that moment, watching Yui standing on your tank, the Apaches flying overhead, my guys in contact with your guys, the security positions and the NRABs doing their thing, like that for me is watching the, you know, the modern day manifestation of just the best that people can rise to in absolute tragedy. And while it was such a terrible day for us, like that is an image that still inspires me to this day.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. The Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by Sig Sauer. SIG is a leading provider and manufacturer of firearms, electro-optics, ammunition, air guns, and suppressors. For over 250 years, SIG Sauer Inc. has evolved and thrived by blending American ingenuity, German engineering, and Swiss precision. Today, SIG Sauer is synonymous with industry-leading quality and innovation, which has made it the brand of choice amongst the U.S. military, the global defense community, law enforcement, competitive shooters, hunters, and responsible citizens. Sig Sauer is also a premier provider of elite firearms instruction and tactical training at the Sig Sauer Academy located in New Hampshire. For more information about Sig Sauer and its complete line of products, visit SigSauer.com.
Well, sir, and you are a sir, because you were a captain when I was a first lieutenant when we were working together. How would you like to introduce yourself?
Heston Russell, like yourself, mate. I'm a veteran. I'm a former serviceman now, but yeah, I was a commando captain in Afghanistan where we served together in 2012, and I've since got out. I got to the rank of major and got out in 2019, and now I sort of head up a veterans charity. I'm actually having a run at the politics here in Australia this next year as well.
Awesome. And it's your birthday. It's your birthday here in the States. It was your birthday yesterday in Australia, but I think we get to count it.
That's it. It's November 10th here now, but it was November 9th. That's my birthday. And then tomorrow is actually obviously November 11th, which is our Remembrance Day here in Australia. You guys celebrate November 11th, commemorate November 11th as well, don't you?
Right. So that's our Veterans Day. And then tomorrow is the Marines' birthday, which is arguably the bigger holiday for us, at least eyes of all Marines.
Gotcha. Well, semper fi, man.
Yeah. Well, a little background on me and Heston. We worked together on a really difficult mission together in October of 2012, and it was the second time that I was wounded when I was in Afghanistan. And while we were warming up for the show, Heston just sent me a picture of myself talking to him. And before the show, we didn't know that this is who each other were. So this is really wild.
Trying to figure out where on the battle space you were during that, you know, 3 days, but you were actually the Marine tank troop commander assigned to my platoon for that mission.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is crazy. You know, I talk about that mission quite a bit, and a couple of funny things. There's a lot that's not funny, but one of the funny things is when we're planning that mission, we flew over to your base in Kandahar, and me and another lieutenant got there like an hour before our CO got there, and somebody met us, and they said, "Hey, the Brugies are in the mess," or however you know, Australians talk. So I was like, fuck, I don't know what a Brugie is, but I bet I can drink three of them before the skipper gets here. You know, I thought that you guys would have beer in there or something, but what you were saying was the brew gear is in the mess. So that meant like hot chocolate and tea and coffee and whatever. And then I trotted in there. I was looking for beer. I couldn't find anything. I was kind of disappointed. And I went over and there was a hot water kettle and it had the temperature readout on it. And it said 98 degrees. And I was like, oh, great. That's not too hot. I can drink this right now. And it turns out y'all are working off the old metric system. And that was pretty hot. I burned the hell out of my mouth.
Us and the rest of the Western world, but that's okay.
Yeah. The planning for that mission was really eye-opening for me because I'd worked with British SAS. I'd worked with American Special Forces. I'm a U.S. Marine officer. And I was astounded at your guys' level of professionalism in that mission planning. And it was also interesting how many similarities there were between the way you guys planned missions and the way that we did. But you were very casual and relaxed on the base. But when it came time to actually sit down and make this plan, you guys were flawless. It was really impressive.
No, thanks, Ben. I mean, that's our profession. And as you got to see, you know, I talk about it so much these days and I really miss that detailed planning. But before every mission, you know, there was weeks worth of planning. And too often people in, you know, the regular military or talking about the military talk about, you know, no plan survives H hour. You know, that's definitely a good rule to go by. But the level of planning we sort of get to, the majority of your plan usually survives H hour. However, I guess the mission we're going to talk about, there were definitely a few components thrown in there that changed a few things. But yeah, I mean, that's our profession. You know, this it's our full-time profession and lives depend on it. And I enjoy that stuff and I miss that stuff, to be honest.
So this mission was Operation Helmand Viper. And then there was a number that came after that, right? Because this had been attempted a handful of times before.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because you guys obviously call it something different to us. I think we call it Operation Paladin. And then all of us, we just called it the tank job. But I think the official combined thing was, like you said, Helmand Viper. I mean, this was our first attempt at it. But I think it dovetailed into a different mission set that your regional commander was looking to put forward to clear Keshmesh Khan. And this was a number of those different courses of action. I think one of them was throwing a Marine brigade at it or something, or then they decided the combat power required was a Marine company of tanks and a commando company, and off we went.
Which is a strange mix, right? If you send you know, we brought out 18 tanks. So every tank that we had to bear, we brought to the battle space, and that was every tank in the country of Afghanistan, by the way. Yeah, that was it. The army didn't have any tanks there. I think the Danes had some tanks, but all they did was sit inside of some kind of compound within one of the larger bases. They never went outside the wire. So
so you know, this story, this mission, apart from like me talking about it a couple of times, has never actually been like properly documented here in Australia. Australia has this terrible habit of if anything sounds too good, then we cut it down, call that tall poppy cutting syndrome. But our special forces in particular just operates not in secrecy, but just in silence. Yeah. So this tank job, this operation is literally the first time Australians had employed tanks in combat since the Vietnam War. And it's still not something that's ever spoken about. So to hear it from the insights from you are going to be the first time that so many people have heard it. And the fact that it's coming from you, who was the tank commander there on the ground, is just absolutely incredible because, again, as per the way our culture is sort of skewed at the moment, if it's me talking about it, people are just like, oh, this is another guy talking about what he used to do. Whereas someone else who was there, who was, you know, like you just said, every tank in Afghanistan was dedicated to this job. You know, this is incredible things that our war memorial and our historians like should be grabbing onto.
Well, I think you would be hard pressed to find more than a handful of people in America that have ever heard of Keshmesh Khan. And that was some legit fighting. The most legit fighting that I saw the entire time that I was in country. It was extremely difficult. And you lost one of your own on that mission. We had 30 Marines who ended up getting medevaced out of, you know, a little over 100 guys. So about one in three of our guys ended up getting hurt, mostly on the withdrawal from that mission, which took absolutely forever. It was like a 70-hour withdrawal to get from Keshmesh Khan back to our base.
Yeah, and that's the crazy part is, and why honestly, I'm sorry to hear that, mate, because we didn't really hear that. You know, we heard that you guys encountered some IEDs on the way back, but, you know, even those statistics, you know, I lost Corporal Scott Smith there on the 21st of October, and that's sort of how that mission is easily remembered. But you know, we never got to hear of any of those casualties to your guys. So I'm really interested, if you can, to sort of tell me more about that.
Absolutely. You know, let's kind of piece back together how this mission went down a little bit. We had to road march for a couple of days to get there from our base, and we had some tanks break down along the way, which is a normal thing. Tanks break everywhere they go. They either break what they're up against or they break themselves.
Where were you coming from?
We were coming from Shirgazi.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. So it was quite a ways away. The first night that we got there, we executed a feint and set the tanks up as if we were going to attack another position. I'm not going to give too many details about this, but we executed a feint, lined all the tanks up, and we basically sat there and got shot by sniper fire until it got dark. And the idea was that the oppositional force, being the Taliban, would then put in their IED emplacements in that position and not expect us to go where we did. We employed some psyops and some other things throughout the night to make people think that we're going to continue to attack that other position. And based on the radio traffic that we were intercepting, they bought it. Okay. For the most part. Then the next morning we attacked the other position and we meet up with you guys. And I vividly remember meeting with you guys, because when I'd previously done this mission planning, like, you're in flip flops and board shorts and everything's like, you know, chill factor 9,000 back at your base. And I was like, oh, I'm so jealous of these guys. And then we show up and your faces were fully painted in camouflage. It was a different mentality altogether. And I was like, oh man, like we're all in war fighting mode now. This is happening. It's real. And they're taking this seriously, which was fantastic. Cause that's where my mind was at too.
Yeah, for sure.
What was it like for you to see tanks rolling into the same battle space as you?
Well, for starters, you were late.
Yeah.
It was very surreal, because, I mean, like you said, how many tanks did you say? There were 18 tanks?
18, and I don't know how many of them actually got there. So let's say 16 tanks actually show up.
Well, then also, and I, to be honest, what wasn't fully understood or probably briefed as much, or I probably just didn't focus on it as much, was also everything else that came with you. I mean, we also had the MRABs turn up with the Marine sniper guys, and then, you know, even the supply chain you guys had, and later when we went to Keshmesh Khan, had all those different variants. But so we helicoptered in that night, you know, did a bit of a nighttime huzzah and landed straight onto target, and that was in particular so we could go straight to some of these key compounds that we didn't want to allow them the time and space to, you know, sort of rally things against us in the morning. And we had, you know, signal intelligence of some key people we wanted to go after. And then in the morning, we were actually sort of expecting you guys to arrive before the sun came up, so as we could sort of stuff around, you know, getting gear, because we brought in a whole bunch of extra gear, knowing that for the first time we're going to have these big vehicles that could take some of the explosives and some of the equipment we'd otherwise be carrying. But, you know, things got delayed, as is that great nature of the terrain over there. And next thing in the morning, we actually started having some people driving around our positions and starting to spot on our positions, starting to report on our position. So we actually killed a few people just before you guys turned up. And then you guys rolled in with these tanks. And it was, I definitely felt like there should have been some great theme music playing in the background. It was very surreal watching these big bloody M1A1 Abrams roll in. Same time,
I remember rolling into that compound where we linked up, and you guys had pulled down security, and there's a little dry wadi out next to it. And, a couple guys had tried to roll up on you, and had some night vision, and you killed them there laying out there on the ground. And, and then we kind of linked up and started to figure out what the plan was going to be. And, sorry, we were late. I don't know what to tell you.
This is it. Like, it's great. It's so fascinating for me to have this conversation with you, because for those listening and watching, you know, that was one of 67 missions we did, and it was very monumental, obviously, for us. But we had so many more missions, and as is that crazy world over there, you just get drawn back into it. And the fact that just randomly you and I have found each other on Instagram like yesterday, and now having this conversation today, and is the first time we've actually been able to debrief on this. Like it's war, mate. You know, the great level of detail planning we have, like this is still war. And, you know, I'm an absolute perfectionist even in today's life. So, you know, I like things to run to plan, but mate, you know, we rocked up, we linked up and we made it happen, didn't we?
Yep. I had a breaching vehicle that was attached to me, which was not a normal thing. And the guy driving that was an absolute madman.
It was called Mr. Plow, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That's it. I have this image of Mr. Plow. I remember it. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was actually really instrumental in actually driving to the final objective because we ended up running into some walls that we weren't anticipating. And that guy just went full wrecking ball and drove through all these freaking walls. And you guys kind of walked through the rubble behind him and got straight to the objective so that we could all get out of there. He ended up actually striking a couple IEDs on the way out and was badly injured. And the next time I saw him was at the Wounded Warrior Battalion back in North Carolina. So by the time, you know, this is months later, both of us had gotten back and then our units say, hey, you need, you know, all you need to focus on is medical stuff. That's kind of what Wounded Warrior Battalion is. And that's where I saw that dude again. But so at one point we'd push through the small town and I was sitting over a hill and I think I had a couple of trucks and I had all four of my tanks, I had my recovery vehicle. And there were some elders that were meeting way off to my left. And there was this draw, this valley between us. It was about 1800 yards away. And I could see this moped start from my right. And he had, you know, maybe a couple miles to go in front of me. And you called me over the radio and asked if I could see him. And I said, yes. And then you said that you'd intercepted signals intelligence, that he was planning on planting IEDs for the tanks and asked me to engage him. And this is where it gets complicated because you and I didn't get to talk about this before.
Yeah.
Previous to this mission, like the week before, we'd gotten this tactical directive that had come all the way down from the president of the United States to us that said that we couldn't engage a target unless it was capable of defeating us. Right. Okay. So basically for a tank, that's bad news because that means that I can't shoot anything unless it's a tank that can kill me. And there's not very many of those in the world in the first place. So we're out there fighting with handcuffs on. And, you know, you and I had a back and forth and I could tell that you were frustrated. Of course, I wanted to kill this guy. And it was an absolutely terrible thing. What happens either later that day or the next day, and I don't have this clearly in my mind, is your corporal, he stepped on an IED that was built for a tank and it killed him. And I think about him and I think about that every day of my life. Every day of my life, as I'm sure do, you know, almost everybody that was part of that mission, I felt like I was in a situation where I could either, you know, shoot the dude on the moped and go to jail or not, and accept the consequences. And, it is an ugly ass thing to look back on that.
Yeah, man. No, I hear you. And look, first and foremost, Scotty stood on an IED that had been buried for a long time. And it was inside a compound and it wasn't where that dude went to. So you need to sort of free yourself of that expectation or that assumption. You know, it's not that the IED that killed him was not an IED that dude touched. Like we know that. Unfortunately, it was Scotty's time. And, you know, he was the absolute best at what he did. And the fact that his life is gone is just an amazing legacy for the rest of us to live up to, deserve, you know, what he gave us. But the fascinating part about that was you could imagine me finding out that you guys had that directive only after then being on the ground with you. you kind of would expect that to be something that we might have discussed beforehand. But, you know, you and I and the team, you know, we did our sort of planning and those sort of conversations were saved for our company commanders. You guys call it company commander or squadron commander?
Company commander.
Yeah, our company commanders who were positioned together elsewhere. But yeah, I had heard something about there'd been an engagement where a truck was hit and had civilians on it or something. So, I mean, that was really, really frustrating for me because, you know, we had that perfect intelligence, and per the rules of engagement, that person was someone who we absolutely wanted to remove from the battle space. And you were the only one who had the distance to be able to reach out and touch him. But, you know, we can't change that, can we?
Nope, we can't. Yeah. We can't.
But I think by best talking part for about me realizing that is then, and then we had, when we lost Scotty, you know, realizing that the rules of engagement were not as strict for those who were in the trucks, who were in the MRAPs, and were able to sort of bring them in and help them, help us out with those non-tank defeating targets.
Yep. And I mean, while there's nothing we can do to change it, by having this absolutely insane opportunity at being able to talk to each other about this and the people that get to listen to this, hopefully we can prevent this type of, you know, nonsense from occurring in the future, at least to a limited degree. There's always nonsense in war, but we can limit it to the greatest extent possible by learning from the ways that it's gone wrong before.
Yeah, and absolutely, man. And this is it. Like, you literally just put me on the back foot when we, just before we came on camera, because I asked you, oh, you know, which element on the ground we were with. I was actually the commander here. And I was like, oh, well, I was the one who lost Scott. And you obviously look completely different facial hair now to what you did back then. And I've held resentment. I've held resentment for years, mate, from what happened there on the ground, from, you know, not knowing that you guys were allowed to employ your main weapon systems. You know, that as me as a commander on the ground, I was really relying on you guys to be able to do a hell of a lot more that you could. And it's taken me a bit to get over that. But that's why it's just so incredible to have this conversation here with you now, because if there was one person I probably didn't want to talk in this conversation, it was you, just because I've held that resentment. But here we are. So now we get to have this conversation. And as per everything in life, we need to lean into these conversations, because, you know, even just you saying that to me now, it helps to relieve so much of that resentment that I've been feeling, because I didn't fully completely understand what was going on. Like, I just thought you guys were not allowed to engage because of this previous incident. I didn't realize like there was even that clarification over, you know, it having to be a tank defeating thing. And since that deployment, you can imagine I have then encountered such similar bureaucracy and policies and directions that I can actually now understand how something so stupid can be said and what it is like being the person on the ground. And even just hearing that memory that you've cast and that thought of having any form of responsibility for Scotty's death, like, you know, myself as Scotty's commander, that's what I say here and now, like, you need to remove that trauma. You need to remove that thought from yourself. And just at the same time, I'm able to help work through some of that resentment I carried into this conversation.
Well, I don't blame you a bit for that resentment. And, you know, if you, you know, you can obviously remember that frustration as quickly as it occurred then. Like, that was our frustration for the entirety of the deployment. For the entirety of the deployment, I did over 100 missions like that. It was incredibly painful to sit there and just soak up getting shot over and over and over again and not be able to do anything about it. Absolutely brutal. So
you guys were bullet magnets too. I just remember, I couldn't believe it. And when we first started, just watching how much every random bad guy, they were using those Kerez systems. So the Kerez, for people listening, is like the underground water movements, but then it has sort of these wells that pop up and you can move through it. That's where they hide all their weapons and equipment. And we were just watching people from satellite feeds up, from drone feeds up above, popping out of these Kerezes and taking shots at the tanks. And, you know, whether they were AKs or they were RPGs, they were just the bullet magnets.
Yeah. So my tank actually ended up getting disabled so that the turret wouldn't turn back and forth. And when we were on the way out, my tank was being towed by my recovery vehicle, and I was in the recovery vehicle, and we hit an IED at the front of this vehicle chain in a pass, and everybody came to a stop. And I looked out to the left and somebody popped out of a Kerez hole, and I saw the tube of an RPG start to come up. And I shot and killed him with my rifle, and he slumped back down into the hole. It looked like somebody was handing him the RPG up. So one of the other tanks drove over there, dropped a grenade in the hole, and then we continued on. We actually ended up striking, I think, 3 IEDs in that pass, and I was right next to, another tank when it hit the IED, So all the blast came out from underneath that tank and hit me. And then we went on down. So I was all jacked up from that. And then we went all on down to our assembly area and somebody skipped a recoilless rifle like 2 miles away. And that hit me in the middle of my back, you know, just randomly. All of us were just kind of getting shredded by the time we got out of there.
Yeah. It's just incredible what they have there. And, you know, the M1, the Abrams tank is, you know, this big, awesome beast. And it definitely is, you know, you saw those pictures in Iraq of all the guns hanging out of it, but you know, it depends how many times it gets hit. And, you know, that terrain over there is unforgiving, isn't it?
It is. It is. And, you know, they can take a lot of abuse. And, at one point I had, I don't know, 4 or 5 of your guys and your bomb dog on top of my tank, and we hit an IED, and it was either buried too deep or it wasn't mixed properly. And it wasn't a huge explosion. It just shot out from underneath the vehicle. And I just remember, you know, feeling like something very lucky had just happened for all of us, because we're all exposed, you know, we're extremely vulnerable outside the vehicle like that.
Yeah. That photo I've sent you, Kootsie, who's one of the sergeants, he's the guy in the foreground, and he's out now. And so he's fine, you know, at least being identified as Kootsie. I remember him sort of sending that over the radio that he just hit some form of an IED and it sort of fizzed out. But, you know, that was very surreal, particularly that area. And we knew it per the enemy threat. And, you know, that's that building that Scott was killed in. They were just making IEDs. So there was over, I think, 200 IED components, enough to make over 200 IEDs or whatever it was in that compound that we lost Scott. And that had a pressure plate IED at the front blocking it. But then all over that place, you know, they had them pre-laid and they just went and armed them. And that's why to hear about how much you and your guys got attrited on the way out, it's just incredible. People don't really appreciate that. They keep thinking, you know, it's farmers who pick up weapons and whatnot, but particularly over there in Helmand and particularly around that Kajaki Fan, Keshmesh Khan area, they were seasoned fighters and they knew what they were doing.
Well, I was also the tank that drove into that compound to try to recover some pieces of Scotty and his GPS right before those rockets came in and blew it up. And we knew that there was other IEDs in there. And one of your engineers was on the front slope of my tank. That was terrible. You know, that was incredibly tense.
I think just to quickly talk through that though. So this was what that morning of that second day. And I was actually back at a compound, probably about 500 meters back from the compound that Scott and his team were in. And that compound had actually been shooting on our company headquarters. Your boss and my boss were together and they just managed to randomly decide to push up on my left flank and into my platoon AO without letting me know. And then all of a sudden they started getting fired at from in and around that compound. So I sent that team up, my team, team three, my other senior team sergeant. And, you know, they were conducting their clearance. And the next thing I heard, Trent over the radio, who's just saying, you know, we've had an IED. And then he came over straight away and confirmed that Scotty was the call sign. Papa 1-2 was gone. And I remember calling back one of your tanks that was immediately there to get to me. I was there with my platoon headquarters, and we jumped on the top of that tank and just, you know, said, head a beeline directly for that compound. And then we sort of turned up to that compound, and there was mainly the partner force lined up out the front looking pretty scared. You can imagine when an IED goes off, the partner force just don't want to move. But then I remember I got down, joined my guys, and what we did was was that actually your tank? Got you to drive from where we were over to break a hole through the compound next to us so then we could walk in the tank track line.
Yep. And actually, I think it was my tank that you guys jumped on as well. And if I remember right, you had an interpreter or something that like got his fingers caught in the sprocket on his way up.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That was that little interpreter. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So you remember, you remember we turned up. I don't know if you remember, because I think you guys were closed hatch at that time. Or you might have been, I don't know. But we turned up to it and you sort of stopped short and I jumped down and went over to the guys and then called you in to bust a hole into that next compound. And then I remember we started to try and defile the partner force just walking on it, because everyone was so petrified. The partner force particularly was so petrified of IEDs. Obviously, once the guys had told me that you know, a couple of hundred IED components in that building. It was like, right, everyone, you know, all call signs, really, really watch where you're walking, make sure your engineer call signs are clearing out front. But the best thing we had for fast movement was, you know, if a tank had driven over something, then there was a higher probability that there wouldn't be any IEDs. So I remember calling your tank forward to us. You punched a hole into that next compound, busting through the wall. And then we started moving in the track. And then all of a sudden, as we were crossing between those two buildings, we just started to get smashed by people firing at us. And that's when I remember, I think my sort of key frustration was, because I think you guys then closed down because you were taking fire as well. You'd pushed off back and you were sort of watching over us move across there. And you guys had taken fire as well. And we were getting smashed and I had to like take two trips to get the partner force back. And I remember trying to like, I changed the frequency on my radio to try and contact you guys, but I think you must have like closed down and maybe put your ECM on or your electronic countermeasures or something. And I just remember I couldn't get in contact with you. And I think I went to go to the back of the tank, like thinking or remembering like that's where there was like a phone there. Yeah. And then you guys started reversing and I so nearly got hit. I just like lost my shit. So I grabbed a rock and I like threw it at the turret. And then I was like yelling at you. And I think you then popped up your head. And that's when I yelled at you and I was, because we'd had this conversation about how you weren't able to engage with something. And I wanted you to just simply turn and fire your main armament at like the hill. I think I remember telling you like,
I remember this so well. I remember this so well. And I was on the radio talking to my boss, like, please let me fucking help these guys. And okay. I was like, I'm not even shooting anybody. I'm just going to shoot dirt. Nobody cares about dirt. And couldn't do it.
Yeah. So you and I had that chat. You'd actually been pretty good that day before saying, hey man, you know, I'm really on these tight restraints. And I was still scratching my head over it, but I was like, cool. So, you know, maybe we might be able to do this, you know, turn and shoot at something, because you and I know, and for those listening, like for the main armament of an Abrams to go off, you know, in Afghanistan, particularly in that contact situation, like no insurgent is, you know, keeping their head popped up. As a bare minimum, you're going to bias that split second time for people to go, holy shit, what was that? And that's all that I sort of needed to get the rest of those guys across that gap, because we were so open and exposed. And I remember you trying to do your thing and then you sort of came back to me and you're like, no, we can't do that. And I just remember that's where I was like, right, well, fuck is, you're fucking useless to me. But yeah. Then at that same time, straight away following, because I obviously wasn't listening to your communications, but your MRAB drivers must have been, they pulled up straight away and they were like, hey, sir, you know, we can jump in here and help out. And I think they just started pouring Mark 19 rounds down into that Carrez system in front of us. And yeah, it was that was such an emotional time. And like I was saying to you beforehand, like I was really angry, because I just know how much, you know, a main battle tank round going off would have just helped me so much. And as it turned out, no one got injured and we ended up doing it. But as you can imagine, it just came at such a hyper emotional time. I mean, I don't want to get into the details on this, but as I'm there yelling at you, you know, like around me are parts of Scott. In the compound are parts of Scott. You know, we recovered Scott over about, you know, two football field sizes of an area. It wasn't just like So it was a very all-immersive environment, to say the least. And unfortunately, you really bore the brunt of it from me. So I probably actually really should apologize to you, mate, because I was in a very frustrated time. And as far as looking back on my history, the history of my career, if there was one time that I probably wouldn't like to have taken it so much out on, you know, you and you in particular, your tank right there in front of me personally, it was probably then. But it was just the nature of the situations, and you unfortunately literally copped both barrels of my frustration.
You don't owe me any kind of apology. You were doing everything that you could do to keep your guys alive and accomplish the mission. And I was doing everything that I could do. And, you know, we just had different constraints. And, you know, we don't talk enough about how detrimental these rules of engagement and and tactical directives, and this other nonsense actually ends up hurting our own forces. But
you know, we could have really cut through that day if we were able to do our thing.
Oh my God.
I just think the biggest thing, I get chills now thinking about it. If you and I were able to actually work together the way in which doctrinally we could, like, there would have been some very, very sad insurgent families that day.
Yeah. No. Oh. And our own forces would have been healthier, happier, and more effective. Like, we were the tool. We were the tool that was available. We just couldn't do it. We weren't allowed to do it. And it was freaking awful.
That moment you said before of your tank going into that compound and Newey was the engineer sergeant who was on the front of your turret. And that image, mate, is burned into my head. So Newey was the boss of Scotty. He had his gray hair and he was there with like his search pole, literally trying to fish out some of Scott's equipment that had been blown over that. And I just remember looking at this guy trying to recover parts of his soldier and just saying, you know, no one should ever have to do that. And there he was working with you guys, like doing it so professionally. And, you know, like if I wasn't the platoon commander, I didn't have responsibility. Like my heart was, you know, absolutely on the floor watching that. But I remember exactly at that moment, two Apaches flew over and Apaches weren't allowed to fly in Helmand because it was actually a different area. It was meant to be the Marines, but they were our US Army guys. And they had just literally broken boundaries and decided to fly overhead and join in. And that moment, we have our Anzac Day, dude. It's on the 25th of April. It's when we sort of celebrate that Anzac spirit and commemorate that landing at Gallipoli. And Anzac spirit for us is about those who fight through in the face of, you know, hell on earth and that, you know, spirit to fight through. And that moment, watching Yui standing on your tank, the Apaches flying overhead, my guys in contact with your guys, the security positions and the NRABs doing their thing, like that for me is watching the, you know, the modern day manifestation of just the best that people can rise to in absolute tragedy. And while it was such a terrible day for us, like that is an image that still inspires me to this day. Eh?
Yeah. It's burned in my memory too. That's one that's never leaving, but yeah. So we could talk about this mission for a long time. We accomplished the mission, which had been previously attempted multiple times by hundreds more individuals than what we brought to bear. But we got it done in spite of everything we had going against us. So, you know,
I love your insights on that final. So I remember we had this like big, I ended up having this big confrontation with my boss because, you know, we had to change the plan after we lost Scott. There were so many IEDs. You guys were getting these IED strikes as well. And remember, we developed that plan that the other platoon did that overt exfil, and then my platoon linked up with all of the tanks and the vehicles, and we did that big battle run into Keshmesh Khan, and we fired the Miklik and all of that. Yeah. I'd love to hear that from your perspective, man, because, again, that's, like, never been done in, like, Australian military history. And I tell people about this, you know, firing of the Miklik, how we literally thunder-runned in, you know, Mr. Plow plowing through the walls. And, you know, we didn't actually end up finding a lot on target, just a couple of guys. But that movement in itself, which took all night, was pretty incredible.
And everybody was tired. You know, I'd been up for almost 3 days at that time without getting any sleep. And yep. Actually, I did a podcast with my wingman about this a while ago. When we were driving in to get to the assault position, there was a point that I'd set that he had to turn left and he wasn't turning. And I called him on the radio and I said, you got to make your turn. You're at your point. And he said, I can't. There's a Karez right next to me. And there wasn't. There wasn't at all. He was hallucinating that there was a giant hole in the ground right there. So that was our mental state going into this thing. We finally get to the assault position and then we end up with like wall after wall after wall that are 3 feet thick and 10 feet tall. And it is looking ugly. And then we had this crazy guy and I wish I could remember his name, but he was the commander of this assault breacher vehicle that had this giant plow. He could fire a Miklik, which for those who don't know is like a chain of chunks of C4 with a rocket on one end of it, and you fire this rocket and it drags the whole chain of all this C4 out and lays it on the ground, and then it detonates and it blows all the mines and everything out of the way. So we fired a Micklick, and then, you know, we ended up just having that guy basically just do a bonsai run through wall after wall after wall and drove straight through the objective. And he was so covered in rubble that he couldn't see out of any of his periscopes. We actually had to dig him out so that he could open his hatch at the end of it, because he was just trapped under all of this material that he just plowed through. And, it was violence of action, and it was what was called for. Yeah. But the crazy thing is that we were just all at our wit's end. It's like, okay, we can't use our guns, so we're just going to use our vehicles as these blunt force objects to blow through all these obstacles.
Yeah. And that's what happened on target. I remember he must've set that precedent. Obviously I was locked down in one of the MRAVs at the back, and, when we rocked up on target, you know, next thing, each one of my team sort of got into their ground level clearance, going to these compounds, but they were working in conjunction with a tank who was then like plowing through the walls to help them get through it. Cause like you said, these are big, thick walls, and we weren't using doorways. We'd taken enough explosives in, so we were going to blow in through these breach holes. And you and I had also seen, you know, the thousands of civilians walking up over the hill the 2 days beforehand. You know, as soon as we turned up on target, they were just, we knew those who were left on target were bad people, let alone we were listening to them as well. But
that was a crazy thing. It was like an old Western. As soon as we got there, and I'd seen that in some previous missions, like as soon as the word's out, like that there's a fight, then everybody who's non-combatant leaves. And then everybody else who stays legitimately is there to fight you. And that's why I think those rules of engagement should recognize that and be like, okay, you know, everybody knows if you're still here, you're in the game, you're fair game. Let's do this.
Yeah, that's it. And as you and I both know, it's not like you're just randomly shooting at people indiscriminately. You know, like you said, when there are people there, but the clarification is they need to be able to destroy a tank. That's crazy. But I remember clearing through, going through one of those areas with one of my teams and watching one of your tanks like plow through this wall next to me that I needed to get through. But just on the other side of that wall were two giant Carrez holes. And I mean, like they would have swallowed an Abrams hole. And he hit it going so fast that by the time he knew those Carrez holes were there, they were either side of him. And I just remember having this, oh shit moment, where I'm pretty sure I got on the communications to you and your guys or whoever it was, because I think the call signs had changed by then. And I was like, hey, just make sure you link in with the commando team on the ground, because I just had this picture of this Abrams like being stuck in a Carrez hole, and we would not have got that out.
For sure. Okay. I want to talk about this, this controversy that's going on right now with you guys.
Oh, yeah.
So give me the rundown, because this was the first I've heard of it.
So, same deployment and, same theater of operation. So Helmand province. So what happened on the, October last year, the article actually, came to our eyes and ears on the 21st of October last year, which was the 8th year commemoration of the death of Scott on that job in Helmand. And basically, this article was published by three journalists from, it's called the ABC here in Australia, which stands for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. So that is the only news outlet that is funded by our government, funded by our taxpayer. And it's a US Marine Huey crew member. He said he was a crew chief who went by the name of Josh. He wouldn't give his real name, but in this article, he's talking to camera and he's there in his uniform. And he recites an account of a story where he says things like, you know, we'd flown with the commandos before, we'd seen, you know, when they land, they go in there and they start, you know, blowing up, blowing through walls and taking prisoners and killing people. And he said, you know, on this mission, we had received a call over the radio. He said that they were coming in to pick us up. And we had put a call over the radio saying that we had taken seven prisoners. And he said that he'd just previously seen us, which is a key part. He said he'd seen us crash tackling and hog tying these detainees. So we knew that we had these prisoners. And apparently the call came back that they could only fit six prisoners on board, which obviously wasn't his helicopter because he was in a Huey attack helicopter. And then he said, and this is the account, he said he heard a pop on the radio. And he knew straight away that that meant that we had executed a prisoner. And so the ABC published this story basically accusing November Platoon of killing a prisoner based off the ear witness account of a Marine Huey crew chief during a nighttime operation in Helmand in 2012, and then decided to publish that in 2020. So, that's it in a nutshell, man.
First of all, it's crazy for Americans to even think about a news channel that's funded by tax dollars, and then to think about something like that that would then attack one of its own military units, an elite military unit at that, which with a record as distinguished as that is yours, and then to have that based off of somebody who won't even identify themselves because they heard a pop on a radio on it at night from another helicopter. Like, that's nothing. That's nothing. I've heard every sound on a radio, all of the sounds. Like, that's nothing. It's ridiculous.
That's the wild part for me is, you know, the key parts. And what we've done is myself and a bunch of the guys from the platoon wrote a 10-page letter. And anyone who wants to read this, I've got a website. I'll give it to you. It's vsf.org.au/ABC. And you'll find it all there. And we've written this response. We're starting a petition here to our government. But the simple fact is, so all of our insertions and extractions into Helmand always had to be conducted at night because the Marine Air Wing, the MOR, would only come and do that at nighttime given the rocket threat, the ground surface to air threat. So this guy was a crew chief on a Huey helicopter, which didn't pick up passengers. They were there providing fire support. So, you know, they were never coming into land. And as you would know from our meticulous planning, we always know how many seats there are on a bloody helicopter. You know, to say to me that we're radioing up saying we don't know how many seats is like one of the biggest insults you can have. And also, it's not one helicopter that comes to extract a platoon. It's like four or five. So we would always move them around to another helicopter if we wanted to. But then for this guy to even say that he saw us tackle and hogtie a bunch of guys on target, first and foremost, he's in a Huey gunship thousands of feet above the ground at nighttime in Helmand, looking through night vision goggles, and he reckons he can see us crash tackling and hogtying Afghan insurgents. One, that's impossible. Two, have you ever seen anyone crash tackling and hogtying Afghan insurgents? Like, it never gets to that, you know, that as soon as you get close enough to them, they try and throw their weapon down and pretend like they're a farmer. Like, also, how impractical is it to hogtie someone? What are we doing then? Carrying him to a man to the HLS?
No, it's ridiculous. Everything about it is ridiculous. And it should stop at that. It's like, okay, here's a person who is having some type of mental health crisis. Let's get that looked at because he's in a bad place right now. Not let's publish a story about this and try to defame one of our own SF units. That's just crazy.
Yeah, man.
And they owe you an apology.
I really do appreciate the support. And that's all we've literally just asked for an apology and for the story to be rewritten because, I mean, as you and I know, you know, that time for me in Afghanistan with my guys was, you know, the best version of me because of the mission we had, the people I worked with, and, you know, the circumstances we were in where you were truly tested, you know, to the limits of what you were trained to be and your beliefs and everything else. And, you know, for some guys, like that is such a huge legacy for them. And for all of a sudden have that to be undermined by, you know, our own National Broadcasting Service, who even now a year later are unwilling to review it, even if we provide them with all the information. And just the effect that has on my guys who now have kids, who Google November Platoon. And the crazy part is, dude, like no individual unit down to a platoon has ever been named in such a way, in such a defamation, let alone a special forces unit in the entire of Australia's history. And the only one is November Platoon. So these guys' kids can see their November Platoon patch in their you know, metal cabinet display, and you know, we'll Google that, and that's the one story they find. And some of my guys are saying, I just want my grandkids and whoever else to research to not see that. But then the issue is, this also now comes after the fall of Afghanistan. This comes after the Taliban are back in control in Afghanistan, and I was already speaking forward on the veterans' mental health space and speaking out against this. And now there's, you know, about a dozen of my guys who want to speak up and take on this story. But in order for them to correct the faults of keyboard warriors who don't even care about it, they have to expose themselves as being those former special forces members who took the fight to insurgents and terrorists, and to do so potentially open themselves up to real harm, their families to being really attacked by extremists, or to having people, you know, who are just not willing about the facts, you know, target them and target their employment, and they have to potentially risk themselves again after already risking themselves in actual combat just to correct someone else's lies.
It shouldn't have never come to that. It's just, I'm sorry. I'm just sorry that you guys are having to deal with it. I've talked about working with you guys quite a bit on a handful of different podcasts and not just my own, but every time that it comes up, I say that your task force was the most professional and proficient military force that I ever worked with. And it's not even close. You're the best. And I think that you're the best in the world. I honestly believe that. I think that you guys are better than anything the United States has to offer that I ever saw. And there's some good units out there that I didn't work with. So I don't have the full picture, but you guys are incredible. And you shouldn't have to deal with anything like this that is so thin and so obviously wrong that could ever tarnish that reputation.
I really do appreciate that, man. And that's what, you know, what we did there in Afghanistan, and particularly what we did there working with you guys, you know, you got to see us at our absolute best. You know, we trained specifically for that role, and I will happily take that compliment back to the guys. And I definitely thank you for that, because, you know, that's what we pride ourselves on. And I love your analogy before of, I was definitely in flip-flops and shorts the first time we met, but when it was game on, it's game on. And that's what we pride ourselves on. That's when we're fighting and playing that championship game for our country. And, you know, for people to then come in and, you know you did something as near to as perfect as can be done in this world, for as near to the most perfect reasons that they can be in this world, and to then have someone who was not even there come out and slander that at a time when, you know, many of us have been struggling with missing that stuff and, you know, missing that camaraderie and remembering back to that best version of us, it hurts. It really does hurt. And just to even hear you, you know, be able to provide that external assessment and affirmation from a non-Australian accent, therefore you're less likely to be cut down in this tall poppy cutting syndrome society we have here, is incredible. And this is just an incredible time, and that you and I have managed to meet up with all this going on with Remembrance Day tomorrow. And you've really helped, you know, boost my spirits 100%, man.
Well, honestly, you have too. This is just an incredible coincidence. And really it's the second of which has occurred. And I'll give you the other one quickly. Yeah. I think it's been 3 or 4 years ago. I was in Tierra del Fuego, Argentina, the southernmost point of Argentina, doing a fly fishing show. And on the way back, I think I had like 50 hours of flights and travel. And, you know, I was just exhausted. I just wanted to be home. I kind of had to bribe my way out of Argentina. They're a little bit slimy in the airport and like held onto some fly rods and stuff and whatever. I was pissed. I just wanted to be home. So I finally get back to Boise, Idaho. And from there, I have to take an Uber to my hotel and get my truck. And then I have a 4-hour ride back home.
Yeah.
I get the Uber, and the guy's name is Mahmoud, and he looks like he's Afghan. And to be completely honest, that's just not where I wanted to be at that time. Like, I didn't necessarily want to hang out from Afghanistan at that stage that I was at mentally. And the dude shows up, and I was wearing shorts, and he saw some of my tattoos, and he asked if I was a Marine. I said, yes. And he said, were you in Afghanistan? I said, yes. And I said, are you from Afghanistan? Yes. Awkward. 8-minute ride to the hotel. Start driving. And again, I look different now. I've gained like 50 pounds. I have facial hair. And he says, were you in Kapshirgazi in July of 2012? I was like, oh, you have my full attention. And I am ready for anything at this point, up to and including like reaching over and trying to figure out how to kill this guy. I was like, yeah, were you? And he goes, yeah. And he was an interpreter that was attached to some Marine unit that like traveled through there, and he helped de-escalate this very near miss, like green on blue conflict that, you know, was about to turn super ugly. I didn't remember this guy at all. And he talked about what a shame it was that the Taliban had retaken that part of the country. He had gotten his green card to move to the US with his family after several years of service as an interpreter. He was driving Uber during the day. He was going to college at night. His wife was working, his kids were in school, and he was actively pursuing the American dream. And I couldn't be more proud of him, you know? And I wish that I had like kept up with that guy, but I was just flabbergasted, you know, 8 minutes, car ride's over. I'm never see him again.
Man, but that's those small moments that come into your life. I love your response. And you're like, you have my full attention. It's such a topical conversation too, dude, because just in August, you know, we saw the collapse of Afghanistan, and here in Australia, we have been working through next Monday. I will go before our federal Senate to give evidence before a committee that has been called together to assess our commitment to Afghanistan, in particular, how we have failed and left, you know, people, including interpreters and Australian citizens over there struggling to get back. You know, we even withdrew our guys before the final part of their withdrawal. And this collapse of Afghanistan, particularly for the veteran community back here and all of the work I do at the moment in the charity space, has really hurt so many, given that it's kind of been the culmination of our legacy. But that's why stories like this, man, are so key, because you know what it's like these days. It's so easy to put everything into one big generalized statement. Was it worth it? Whatever. But you and I have been here able to have a conversation that, you know, we should have had so many years ago. And I don't know, but you've helped me, and hopefully I've helped some part of it for you as well. And reflecting on those parts that are those inspirations that remind us that it was worth it, that remind it there are those amazing stories that, you know, you can have impact on people's lives, like resettling that Afghan guy to the US. I'm fighting with people here in Australia who are like, no, you know, we can't have them come here. I'm like, they are some of the best people because they have the perspective of how hard it is to live lives in survival, and they will come over here and thrive and be better for it and help us to reconnect with what are meant to be our national values and what we want our own people to aspire to, but we've become too entitled these days, and instead of being responsible and understanding what we do have. So yeah, man, these are crazy coincidences, but thank God we had them.
Yeah. And just to make this perfectly clear, like I posted a picture of a tank from Helmand Province and talked about this mission a little bit back in October. And yeah, Heston followed it and followed this page and then commented on it yesterday. I looked at his profile and I was like, this dude looks vaguely familiar. Looked at you a little bit and I was like, oh yeah, he's part of the Australian military. This would be a great dude to have on the podcast right now. And then it turns out like everything else, like, holy shit, what a coincidence. It's fucking mind blowing to me.
Well, someone sent me that photo and they're like, oh, you know, this sounds similar. And that was the crazy thing in the comments of that photo, dude, you wrote, you know, one Australian commander killed 33 Marines medevaced. And we touched on that on the start. Like, I never got to hear that, mate, like 33 Marines medevaced. Please tell me more about that.
It was mostly just IEDs, man. Like we just got tore up with IEDs on the way back. And, you know, like that the one that hit me the hardest, you know, a truck had gotten hit and my CO drove his tank into the truck to get all the dudes out of there so that they didn't have to walk out. Cause now we have two trucks that are struck in this pass. So we have no idea how many IEDs are laden in there. He drives his tank into the truck. They all get out on top of his turret. He's backing out as I'm driving next to him in this M88 recovery vehicle that's dragging my busted ass tank right after I just shot the dude that was trying to kill me with an RPG. And he drives over an IED, splashes that thing all over me. Everybody on top of his tank got bad concussions. So yeah, it was just one after the next. And by the time we all got scraped back together, like we basically had to go through the entire company and test everybody to see if they had concussions. And 33 people failed and had to get medevac. And then, you know, several of us had to actually stay in recovery for quite a while. And then I got shot with that recoilless rifle on top of that by just an act of God shot, you know, from a couple miles away. And, you know, that was the second time in the deployment that I'd been wounded. So my first mission, I got wounded as well. My gunner got killed and I had three critical wounded and amputees on all of those guys. But we'd already had a really tough deployment. And then, you know, that set us back again. And I ended up staying in country and I finished out the deployment.
How much longer was the deployment?
We didn't rotate home until February.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So I probably did another 30 or 40 missions after that. And so then I rotated home and then started getting assessed by, you know, a little bit better doctors, and they took me out of the fight. And then, you know, a year and a half or 2 years later, I got medically retired and moved home.
Yeah. Gotcha. So, wow, man. I'm so sorry to hear about that. You know, I used to get the funny nickname apparently of half on Hesto. So half is Hilo Assault Force and on is obviously as close to the target as possible, because I really hated working with vehicles because I was so worried by the amount of IED risks and also just that prolonged time of exposure. You know, I definitely got spoilt on most of the missions to be able to land close to targets. And then, you know, at the end of that mission, we walked about a mile off target and then got helicoptered out. You know, and we're back to base, and apart from being shot at a few times and unfortunately a helicopter accident that killed two guys from the other platoon during that deployment, you know, it was at least a nice, quick, safe route back. But to hear that you guys had to go through all of that with us on the ground and then actually, you know, face all of that alone afterwards, kind of, you know, I'm sorry for that. And it's actually, you know, I'm really disappointed that one, you don't really hear about that. I didn't really heard about that. And, you know, my head immediately goes, you know, what we could have done to maintain like a helicopter packet in support of you guys. But,
you know, I don't think that was it. I think it was just the nature of having to ground travel all those vehicles back. You know, there was one thing that you guys did for me, because, and I don't know if you remember this or not, but we were talking at one point about the tactical pause, because you guys broke contact during a firefight to have tea. And that freaked me out, because that's not something that I do. And I remember calling you on the radio and being like, hey, you guys going to get in the game or whatever. And I swung the freaking main gun over and looked at you, and you were hunkered up behind a wall and busted out a jet boil, and you were going to brew up some tea, and just couldn't be bothered with bullets going over the top of you. But when I was at that concussion recovery center, you guys sent me a jet boil and one of your unit t-shirts and a note that said, never miss a chance to brew up. And, that was a really sweet thing. And, I still have that jet boil. I've outgrown the t-shirt, but, no, that was very cool of you.
We heard that, your tank had got dusted up on the way out, but I never heard statistics like 33 dudes. And, you know, that's pretty hectic to hear. Just, I think we need to quickly clarify this story of me choosing not to engage in conflict and have a jet boil. For starters, I didn't have a jet boil.
It was you.
One of my guys. Funny.
Thing to do, because actually the guys that were firing broke contact. And I think they figured that something big was coming in, and that was the end of the firefight.
Well, you remember what it was like, dude. You know, you could be up there at alert 24/7 for some idiot just having pot shots at you. And when you're there for 3 days, like, unfortunately, you guys really felt it. You know, we really, by that day two, had to get into guys resting and rotating, knowing in particular that we had the biggest fight on our hands, which was going to be fighting on the ground in Keshmesh Khan coming up. Yeah. Oh, wasn't life almost simpler back then?
It was simpler. It was so much simpler. And describing it doesn't make it sound like that, does it? It sounds like it's more complicated, but it was more simple then.
Yeah. Well, particularly when we're dealing with layers of excellence, you know, it was there. We get the most frustration knowing that, like, what we could have achieved, if we had have done things the way that we knew they could have been done, as opposed to abiding by directions of others who were nowhere near there being on the ground. But at the end of the day, you know, through our planning and through our actions, you're able to achieve a hell of a lot, and have that perspective we now carry forward in life to go, you know, this is what can be achieved when people come together for the right reason, put in the hard work, and know what they're doing and why they're doing it.
Well, my hope, if there is one, is that, you know, our countries will learn, and that the things that held us back from being able to do the job better and safer will not hold back troops in the future. There will always be those problems in war. There will always be those problems in war. You know, you're fighting, you know, the guys above you, and you're fighting the enemy, you know, no matter what, especially as a commander, like, you have those two radio channels going all the time. But yeah. I hope that we can improve. And I'm sorry that we couldn't do better for you. I'm sorry that we couldn't do better.
Look, man, we can't change the past, but thank you for having this conversation. Hey, thank you for your service and that of you guys, and the fact that you're still serving by being able to have these conversations, because, you know, these are the conversations that those who weren't there but ask questions about those who were there need to hear. These are those conversations, those who were there to help them reconnect with what they were back then. And for those who we still need to step up and take up that calling to serve in the future, because this stuff isn't going away, and we need as many brave men and women to do things for the right reason. And they can hear these stories, guys like you and I, who can have, you know, confrontation in absolute life or death situations, but then come together and collaborate and have constructive conversations in a world at the moment, mate. I don't know what it's like with you, James, but here, everyone, there are two sides of the argument, and you're in complete disagreeing, and there's no middle ground. There's no compromise. And if you and I can sit here, mate, and bring together the conversations we've had that actually were with regards to life and death, and have had carried resentment and all of this, and work through them constructively and pragmatically, then hopefully other people who are caught up in their own opinions at the moment can perhaps, you know, look and listen and see that there is a different way to do things as well.
That's my hope too. And I hope you guys open your borders one of these days so I can come down there and have a drink with you.
Yeah, man, job's on. I used to travel back to the US a lot as well. And now I know you're there on the West Coast. I prefer West Coast to East Coast. Sorry, East Coast USA people. But yeah, just above California, I have to come up and say, hey, g'day, as we do.
You're welcome anytime, buddy.
Well, stay linked in, James. Hey, where can we find you on socials, mate? What was the account again?
Six Ranch Outfitters or Six Ranch Podcast.
Same. And Heston Ruttle, G-S-O-N. My mom had a crush on Charlton Heston, for all you NRA nuts out there.
Nice.
HestonRussell.com.
We'll link to everything, including your paper to ABC in this, in the show notes of this podcast as well. So encourage you guys to follow and give some love to the Australians, because they gave a lot to us.
Nah, thank you, James. Thank you again, mate. This has been pretty epic. I need to go away and reflect on this.
Yeah, no kidding. All right, take care.
You too, man.
October, November, December, they're just the best months out of the year, right? Whether it's for work or hunting or fishing, the holidays, spending time with your family, just, it's awesome, right? And we've got some nice cold mornings now, and you get to go out and have a warm drink in the duck blind or out on the hillside where you're glassing for mule deer or elk, or sitting in a tree stand waiting for a whitetail to come past. Or you're working on the job site and you get to take a break and have some nice warm coffee waiting for you. It's pretty nice. Having a cold drink at the end of the day, that makes everything a little bit better too. My favorite Stanley item right now is the 14-ounce titanium travel mug. Super lightweight because it's made out of titanium, so I'm willing to take it with me when I'm hunting, throw it in my pack. Fits in every cup holder out there, and it just seems to be the right amount of coffee. I like it. It's a really cool item, and it fits a niche that I didn't have filled in like any of my other drinkware categories, I guess. If you're looking for a Christmas present for somebody or just a gift that you want to help them out with, I recommend this because it's pretty cool and it's something that they don't have already. The way most discount codes work, completely honest, is if you use it, then whoever gave you that code gets a kickback. Now, I'm not a salesman and I want nothing to do with that. So I'm going to pass along to you a discount code that Stanley gave me because they're great supporters of this podcast and they're great supporters of this audience, which I love. So if you use the discount code 6RANCH, the number 6, the word ranch, you'll get 25% off anything you order from Stanley1913.com. I get nothing back from that. I don't want anything. I just want to pass along some savings to you and save you a little bit of money and get you connected with this great company that makes really great products. And as we move through fall and get into winter and the holidays, just hope everybody's doing well and having a good time and that you get to get out there and connect with nature and connect with your friends and family and have a nice warm drink while you're doing it.
We're living in interesting times. If you go to the grocery store right now, you might not be able to find beef or pork or chicken or pet food or toilet paper. And buying beef from a ranch has always been tough because most people don't have enough freezer space or they don't know a rancher or don't live near one. The Six Ranch is solving that for you. This year, we only have 8 spots left in our grassroots beef club, and it works like this. The first week of every month, we ship you a cooler full of all-natural grass-fed Corriente steaks, roasts, and burger from December until May. And being a member in this club also gets you an invite to come tour the Six Ranch during calving season in May and stay for a hosted dinner. Deliveries are available to Oregon, Washington, California, parts of Idaho, and Nevada. Now, this ranch has been in my family since 1884. It's one of the oldest businesses in the state of Oregon. We raise our cattle ethically and use traditional cowboy practices blended with modern grazing techniques. We also put a huge amount of work into wildlife conservation for species like mule deer, salmon, steelhead, rainbow trout, upland bird species. This is healthy beef that you can feel good about eating. Learn more about the Six Ranch and get one of the last shares available at sixranch.com. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share the show with a friend. You can also rate the podcast and leave a review. Your support allows me to keep doing what I love, which is meeting incredible folks and sharing their stories with you. For more content and photos, follow the show on Instagram at Six Ranch Podcast or me at Six Ranch Outfitters. This episode was produced by Emily Brannigan with original music written and performed by Justin Hay. Art for the Six Ranch Podcast was created by John Chatelain and digitized by Celia Christofferson. Tune in every Monday for a brand new episode of the Six Ranch Podcast. I'll catch you next week.